You're listening to episode 98 of Bionic Planet, entitled The Case of the Tangled Titles. Today we're going to try and help you understand one of the most vexing components of the climate challenge, namely the overlapping, interlinking, and contradictory land titles that determine control of so many tropical forests. In this case, the Amazon, the lungs of the planet. With no clarity over control and no realistic way of enforcing it, there is no way to sustainably manage and protect this massive bulwark against climate change. Today's episode centers around a few individuals, most notably a Japan-born physician named Jonas Morioka, who migrated to Brazil in the 1980s, purchased timberland in the 1990s, pivoted to conservation in the 2000s, and is now embroiled in a title fight over a transaction that may or may not have taken place a century ago. His story is far from unique, and it shows how easy it is to chop the forest, how difficult it is to save it, and how 10-year disputes make it even more difficult to leverage carbon finance for the common good.
Man may be unwittingly changing the world's climate through the waste products of his civilization.
There's a group of us now who are proposing that the Earth has actually entered a new epoch, and that is the Anthropocene.
We know that the enemy is carbon, and we know its ugly face. We should put a big fat price on it, and of course, add to that, drop the subsidies.
The world lost over 600,000 square kilometers of tropical forest in the first 20 years of this century, and 70% of what remains is in the Amazon. 42% of the Amazon is located inside Brazil, a country that has a turbulent relationship with this most valuable global resource. Some Brazilian governments have accelerated the Amazon's destruction to sell timber and clear land for farming. Others have promoted the Amazon's salvation for its value as a massive carbon sink and a bulwark against climate change. If the Amazon thrives, the benefits will accrue to all of us in the form of reduced emissions from deforestation and degradation. If the Amazon is further degraded, the benefits will be short-lived and they will accrue to a very few, while the ecological costs will fall on all of us. To meet the climate challenge, we must save the Amazon, and a key component to achieving that is to pay land managers there for maintaining it. But who are those land managers? How do we pay them, and what activities do we pay them for? Carbon standards answer a big chunk of that. They've evolved through 40 years of trial, error, and adjustment to establish procedures that reflect the concurrent views of most experts. Those views are continuing to evolve as science advances, and the procedures are evolving as well. But those land managers are far from monolithic. Some are indigenous people who lived in harmony with the forest for centuries before European invaders came. Some are squatters and landless farmers who drive the bulk of current deforestation. And some are illegal loggers who run roughshod over all these groups and sometimes claim to act on their behalf. Others are large landowners who've had their land for decades, some managing it responsibly, some not, while still others are speculators who bought land with a hot hand and have also driven more than their share of deforestation. You've got people who chop trees out of greed, and people who chop them out of desperation. You've got people who chop them responsibly, and people who chop them indiscriminately, as well as people who don't chop them at all. You've got environmentalists who approach the challenge pragmatically. You've got other environmentalists who approach it ideologically. And you've got both ideologues and opportunists who wrap themselves in the climate cause to push other agendas. Lots of the people impacting the Amazon are shapeshifters, good sometimes, not so good other times. But one thing is clear, decades of research have shown that you reduce deforestation in part by reducing poverty, and you reduce poverty in part by giving people an incentive to manage land sustainably. And one way to do that is to get them tenure, which in Brazil is also a fluid concept, as we'll see today. My guests are Vinnie Maffei and Olivier Lejeune of Quantum Commodity Intelligence. We collaborated in a recent story that they ran called How a Decree Created a Red Old Mess in Brazil and the New Effort to Fix It, which I'll link to in today's show notes. we'll show you how land disputes dating back to the days when Brazil was a colony of Portugal have accelerated land grabbing in the past and are now undermining efforts to save the forest. So, Livia, you and I spend a lot of time talking to project developers, and in some ways, we've both been working on this particular story for years. One of the central figures is a guy named Michael Green, who I've been talking to since 2015. I have to admit, when I first started talking to him, I thought he was kind of naive, and he seemed to be learning by doing, which I guess, you know, we all were as in the early days of this stuff. You know, even now, I find some of his ideas are kind of out there, but enough of his predictions have come true that I generally found him to be a person worth listening to. When did you start talking to Michael?
So more recent than you, Steve, I started talking to Michael in September last year, or August maybe, but yeah, a few months, basically. Yeah, as you say, he's a colorful character. He's got lots of credentials in Brazil, having arrived 16 years ago in Brazil. He's got a Brazilian wife. He speaks Portuguese and he's one of the largest developers in the Amazon, from what we can tell.
Yeah, I don't remember him being that big during my days at Ecosystem Marketplace, and I was surprised when he started issuing credits. I'm mentioning Michael at the start here because he is involved in four of the five projects that are currently suspended, and he's also doing a lot of projects with indigenous people under this new Colombian standard, Cercabono, I think it's called. I don't know much about that standard. I should state up front, Michael is kind of a lightning rod, and I don't always know what to make of him. He's made a lot of accusations against illegal loggers, which I think they probably make sense, but also against competitors, and they've made accusations against him. There's some kind of a territorial fight going on there that I don't quite understand, and I've never actually quoted him because I'm just not on the ground. I don't have the ability to verify what he says. But he's going to be on the show next week or the week after, and he'll have a chance to speak for himself. So I don't want to go down his particular rabbit hole right now. I'd like to make sure we stick to the core of this story because it does have a lot of tangents. And the core of the story is how these project developers got into a situation where their land tenure was uncertain and what that means. The inciting incident in this story is when the public defender filed a suit to stop the projects. And VERA, the standard-setting body that oversees the verified carbon standard, then responded by putting the projects on hold because by their own rules, they can't recognize a project that's in violation of local laws. Now, this has also been pretty controversial. Some people are saying the public defender overstepped her bounds because A, it's not even her jurisdiction, and B, her job is to give free legal advice to poor people. Now, she's not like a state's attorney who speaks for the government, apparently, as I understand it. And under this argument, VERA shouldn't have put the projects on hold because her opinion isn't the law. If this becomes a precedent, anybody who files a suit against a project is automatically going to put the project on ice. Others are saying, no, she's an expert in these types of issues, and she actually had no choice but to do what she did. That's her job, even if it's a different jurisdiction. If she sees something going wrong, she's supposed to step in. VERA, under this school of thought, had no choice but to do what it did because they need to be sure they're not enabling land grabbing. In fact, RED stands for Reducing Emissions from Deforestation and Degradation, and it's supposed to reduce deforestation by reducing poverty. And these projects are supposed to be helping people get registered under the CAR, C-A-R, that's the Environmental Registry in Brazil. And while that's not tenure, it's better than what they had. So, you know, we'll allude to this, these other issues throughout because we have to, but what I don't want to do is get caught up in the fighting between Michael and other developers because at least in my case, I think probably with you too, you know, the more people I've talked to about this, the less agreement I got, you know, and I'm not in a position to go on the ground and see for myself. So I'm basically just calling around and saying, hey, what do you think of this? And everybody in the region kind of knows about it. And you talk to five different people, you're going to get 12 different perspectives. And I think you had the same issue when trying to work through the intrigue and the drama around this.
Completely. Yeah. I think it's a very complex issue. There's lots and lots of history behind it. And there's lots of different people involved. And Brazilian land tenure rights are famously messy and complicated. I can't say we reached a definite conclusion. I don't think we can do that as journalists. We can only really expose what we've listened to and what we've learned through the process. Yeah, I agree with you. I think it's extremely complicated, essentially. Yeah,
and we stayed out of the unsubstantiated claims that people are making against each other, because that's just, we don't know. We don't know it. So if people have heard all this stuff, they're like, are these guys going to go into all the drama that we've heard about? We're not really going to get into that here. Let's look at the nitty-gritty. Let's look at the issues here. We've got these five projects that are on hold. There's the four that have two things in common. One is they were developed partly on private land, where the person who is the landowner used to do logging, had a change of heart around 2008, and then decided he wanted to do conservation. And at the time, there were incursions into the land, and there were laws that recognized the rights of settlers under certain circumstances, and the owner, that's Jonas Morioka, decided he wanted to work with the settlers, get them to do a conservation easement, try to look into this red stuff. And again, 2008, the methodologies didn't even exist then. They were very early movers. He started out with Winrock and then ended up with Michael. And then the other one is the Biophilica one, which maybe you can summarize that one. I don't remember, because I didn't.
Yeah, the Biophilica project is a slightly later project. I think it started in 2014 and was formally filed in 2019, I think. These projects often take years to actually work their way through the registration process because they're very complicated and huge. Jarry is a very famous case in Brazil. I think a lot of Brazilians know what Jarry is when you talk to them about it. An American billionaire went into the region in Pará State in northern Brazil in the 60s and the 70s and basically started this massive plantation in the north of Pará and in Amapá State, which is bordering Pará as well. And the goal was to just produce loads of pulp and paper and to export it to developed markets, developed countries and other markets. And it didn't really succeed. It was a failure. I think they picked the wrong kinds of trees at the time, and they had to sort of redo the project. And it took a long time to become successful, but it is still in operation today. There's basically still plantations. There's still land there with planted trees. And some of that land is now a conservation project, Red Plus, registered under VERA. Mm-hmm. And the project is also on hold for similar reasons to the ones further south in Pará, in Portel. And yeah, we've found quite a few similarities between all of those projects. The bottom line really is the land titles in Pará are quite messy. And there's been over the years claims and counterclaims and judicial decisions questioning the rights of the land. Yeah.
Yeah, that issue's always been lurking there. And it reminds me a bit of the building codes here in Chicago. When I was a kid, the belief was that building codes are impossible to achieve. Every building has a violation. And the cynical belief was that the city only created those unmeetable codes in order for a building inspector to be able to get a second income by extracting bribes, by overlooking things. I don't know how true that is, but it's certainly what we grew up thinking. And I feel sometimes like these land title issues in Brazil are like that. Not by intent, but they're so complicated. And you could almost call anybody out because you can always find something questionable. Maybe we should go to Vinny now, because Vinny is the Brazilian among us, and he's been digging into this more than either of us have. Maybe, Vinny, tell us a little bit about Pará, the state, and Portel, the region. And then maybe we can segue into the story chronologically by looking at the land that Jonas Morioka bought, and then use that to unpack some of these issues in a little more detail.
Sure thing. Thanks so much for having me here today, Steve. It's a pleasure to be here. As you said, it's a very complicated situation. The Portel area, the state of Pará, and it's in the northern state of Brazil, is one of the biggest states of the country. Portel is really famous for the deforestation rates. It's incredibly high at that point. The government of the state has been trying to reduce those deforestation rates. People have been trying to implement Red Plus projects, but of course, it's a whole mess. There's issues with the documentations, there are issues with legislation. You have public defenders now saying and actually actively launching new legal disputes against the projects there. You have past administrations who attempt to implement laws that now were deemed unconstitutional or not valid and they have been questioned. It's a complete mess, as you can expect. And it seems really hard to see how the Pará government, how the state government and the country itself will move ahead of this. Last week, the Pará governor, Alder Barbalho, he was speaking to the Supreme Court. They are trying to come up with this solution to unify legal documents in Brazil. But if it's something very still on the air. It was more of a talk rather than a proposal or something the country will actually go on. But it gives an example of how hard it is. There are 26 states, and each one of them have their own kind of land title documents or models. And then if you go to cities like Portel, they used to be together with another city, a neighboring city called Breves, and now they're separate. And now they have separate notary offices, and then they have to separate those documents. And then you have to... It's so complicated. Even for us, taking a look at that, it took a long time. I can talk to you a little bit more if you want to, how we found all the documents and how we analyzed that.
Yeah, no, I remember when you were digging into that. How did you look into the documents and everything like this?
Yeah, I was lucky enough to have someone in Brazil who is a lawyer. If you are a person, you have interest in any specific legal case in Brazil, as long as you have a lawyer's ID, you can access that. And as long, of course, the case is not running into some kind of justice secrecy or something like that. So with that in mind, I entered into the justice database and we started downloading the documents. We started to see what was there. The first document that I opened had literally 852 pages. That was massive, sometimes in Portuguese, very formal legal style. Even for me, who am a Brazilian, was a little bit hard sometimes to understand. Luckily as well, I had, as I said, a lawyer to help me to understand all that. And during the legal case analysis, what we could see is there have been several legal cases, either on state level, federal level. It has been all the way up to Supreme Court, to federal Supreme Court in Brasilia. You have had now the public defender opening the cases. You have different kind of land titles. You have the National Land Institute trying to issue an opinion, say, about land grabbing. You have the same for the state land agency. There's so many authorities trying to give their saying. And none of them come to a conclusion. One of the cases has been on for more than 20 years. And it also shows how complicated the Brazilian justice system can be. Like, a case can go on for more than 20 years and still have no resolution.
Yeah. It reminds me of Bleak House. Have you ever read Bleak House by Charles Dickens?
I haven't.
It's hysterical. And it's about a court case that's been going on. It's called Jaundice versus Jaundice. It's been going on for something like 100 years. And so long that the people who started it have died and it's been passed on to like descendants. And it sounds a lot like that. And I'm going to move along here because I know you guys got to run, but I think it might be easier if we go into the sequence of what happened, maybe go into Jonas's purchases and everything. Vinny, you did the bulk of the work on digging into this and we don't have to go into the specifics of the project itself, but just looking at the land issues. And when Jonas comes in from Japan, he's a medical doctor and I'll let you take it from there. Or whichever one of you wants to take it from there.
Yeah, basically makes money in Japan's industrial boom in the 70s and goes to Brazil, invests in a number of businesses there and ends up looking at the timber sector, which was pretty much unregulated at the time. And he thought that could be a lucrative opportunity. So he ended up investing in several farms in Pará State. The cost of land was pretty cheap at the time, of course, and he exploited the land for wood, really, was the main goal. He bought the land in the early 1990s, and as early as the 1990s, there were already investigations going on at the local registry office for the land titles, which he says found no issues with the land. And really, the troubles for him, I would say, probably started around 2005, 2006, which is a very special time in Brazilian history. It's basically a time when Lula came to power on a platform to protect the poor and to give land back to the poor. Brazil is very famous for having a lot of large properties owned by just a few people. It's a very unequal country and Lula was trying to curb that at the time. So yeah, that was the context in which a decision was taken in 2006 in the state of Pará It was a decree by the state of Para to essentially block all the large properties in the state. And so that included Jonas Morioka's land and around 5,000 properties in total. So it was a pretty big decision at the time, and not necessarily targeted at Morioka, but we've heard that he may have been one of the key people that the authorities were looking at the time.
And the impetus for that was that they were investigating the local land registrar, right? That's
correct.
And they were saying that there were huge irregularities. So let's just, we'll lock it all up and we'll say, if you're a landowner and you want to reclaim it, you have to start. We start with the assumption that you don't have it.
Yep.
Is that the inaccurate summary? Okay.
That's correct. And there's been no resolution to this, right, really, in the last 20 years. There's been claims and counterclaims. It's gone to the Supreme Court of Brazil. There's been decisions on it. The Supreme Court has said that the decision by the Para authorities at the time was valid, but the titles have kind of stayed in the registry unaltered during that time. And from what we can see, from what we can tell, that the Moriokas continued to control the land as well during that period. And they ended up creating Red Plus projects.
Right.
On that, yeah.
Okay, so they started to create the Red Project after these disputes. Now, I guess it's looking at them, there's two ways of looking at it. One is you want to pivot towards conservation, and the other might be, hey, this thing is coming our way. Why don't we find a way to work with these people who are on the land and stay in the game, in a sense? I haven't phrased it to them that way, but that's something how I can see that would be a logical way to move forward. But now, when the titles were blocked, the registration was blocked, but the titles were not revoked. That's
the key point. Yeah, you're right. Yeah.
What's interesting to say is there's so many timelines we can take a look into this. So the Moriokas, they buy the land in 1990. That's just 5 years after the end of the military dictatorship in Brazil. There's a lot of people. The military itself tried to move a lot of people from the south, which is the industrialized area, towards the Amazon, which it was, of course, very far, and they wanted to integrate the whole country. This has been a project for Brazil for more than a century. And so the 1990s are a very emblematic time for Morioka. He's buying the land. The country has just published a new constitution. But then when you start looking at those lands he bought, if you go back in time, and that's the major point here. It has never been proved that those lands were transferred from public inventory to someone, to a company or a private person. And that's one of the main things.
You have to give us more. Yeah. Give us context on that, because this, now we're actually going back to the days of when you were part of Portugal.
Exactly. So under Brazilian law, back in the 9th century, Brazil was still a colony of Portugal, Portuguese colony. All the land belonged to the Portuguese crown. Once the country became independent, by law, all land in the country belonged to the government, the Brazilian state, unless you bought the land or unless public authorities transferred it to you. And up until these days, unless you can prove that you don't actually own the land, of course, it's a very simplistic way of putting it, that's why I have all those legal cases. But in theory, you should be able to prove a time frame of when exactly the land was transferred, and you need a receipt or a document showing that either the Portuguese or the Brazilian government has awarded you or sold you the land. The point with those lands that they were when they were bought in 1990, the land titles are there in the notary office, and apparently there's nothing wrong. But then when the authorities started reviewing those cases, when the state blocked all of those properties, they came with a point, the question is exactly when were those properties transferred from the public inventory to someone private. We can see that in 1925, there was this Arcangelo Poli, was in theory the first owner of the land. He went to the notary office and he registered the lands under his name. Now, we don't know exactly how the process was, of course, because it's been too many years. But when the point of the authority is, you don't have the document support in this transfer. You don't have how to prove that Arcangelo is actually the owner of the land. But of course, this creates a whole problem for everyone else after that. How can Morioka or whoever it is nowadays necessarily, the notary office should have those documents, but they don't. It's very emblematic of Brazil how things can get complicated, because as Oli mentioned, it went all the way to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court kept those land titles canceled, but they allowed the people, in the case Morioka, to stay in control of the land. And they so they say your title is canceled, but you're still in charge of the land, and you have still a chance to reverse the whole
right.
process. So legally speaking, it's very weird. Even when we speak to lawyers and you show them the time frame, so the transfer, the first buyer, and then 1990 Morioka buys, and then the whole state moves to the block. When they also take a look, it's very confusing because why were the land titles canceled for so long? Why are they still in control of the land? Are they owners of the land, or are they not owners of the land? The Supreme Court said it's okay to cancel the titles, but those didn't say who is right, who is wrong, or what to do, and then sends back the case to Parai State. And so the time frame is so confusing. You can look for so many angles. You can look for the first buyer. You can look from when Morioka is buying, and then you can have to look when the authorities start to actually reviewing all those land titles.
You touched on a couple of things. Just to reiterate, talk about canceled, that means the registration is canceled. Doesn't mean the title is canceled. But the other thing you touched on is they were allowed to maintain control of the land. And there are these three different types of ownership.
The first one would be documentary.
One where the title is there, you clearly own it, and you can sell it, you can do whatever you want.
Exactly.
Within the law, yeah.
The possessional one is the one that you control by being in control, by have a physical presence there. So you are in the land, you have the possession of the land. And the concessional one is when the land is actually public, but the government gives a concession to be there, manage the land. And then, of course, within Brazil, we also have the traditional communities, which fell more or less into the second or third category. So the land is still public, but they are exclusively reserved for indigenous tribes or quilombolas, which are African descendants, people who were enslaved and ran and managed to escape at the time in Brazil. So they created those communities called quilombolas, or it can be ribeirinhos, which are the communities that actually live in those areas. And sometimes they can be there for decades. Sometimes can they move there recently. And the government may or not create a concession for those communities.
Yeah, and one reason, if I understand correctly, for the possessional is going back to the days of the dictatorship. They were worried about squatters coming in from Bolivia, taking land, and suddenly they'd wake up one day, oh my God, the whole western part of our country is full of people who speak a different language and are loyal to a different country. So they're saying to Brazilians, if you go out into the Amazon and you do something with it, because you know they also didn't want people to just buying land and sitting on it like an investment. They wanted it to be actively developed. So they were saying, you go out there, you start chopping trees, you start selling timber, you build a farm, then it's yours. But if you just buy it and don't do anything with it, you lose it.
Yeah, that's what Jonas Morioka says as well. There were clear incentives at the time from the government to move into the region. He says he could have invested in land in Sao Paulo and other places, but chose Para because of those incentives.
Yeah, that's what led to so many of the problems with the indigenous people. Brazil's indigenous population experienced in the 60s what the U.S. population experienced in the 1830s. New people coming in, diseases, gets pretty ugly. It does get ugly, very ugly. And that's one reason I started this show. I've worked with indigenous people and traditional communities around the world, and one thing they taught me is that forest conservation starts with the people in and around the forest. Another thing I learned quite quickly is that some of those most vociferously positioning themselves as champions of indigenous and traditional people are nothing of the kind. In later episodes, I'll take a look at the World Rainforest Movement, which, contrary to its name, is not really worldwide, not really pro-rainforest, and not a movement. You'll see in later episodes what they are. Another group we mentioned today is the Indigenous Missionary Council, or CIMI, which stands for Conselho Indigenista Missionario, pardon my Portuguese, an organization founded by Catholic bishops in the early 1970s to defend the rights of Brazilian indigenous people as a sort of penance for past church transgressions. They've done some great work for indigenous people, but they've also become paternalistic and heavy-handed. As a friend of mine, indigenous leader Elmir Suri, once said, "They've come to see us as their little Indians, and when we misbehave, they punish us."
I found a lot of these groups, like all of us, I guess, have their good sides and their bad sides. And even groups that are ideologically opposed to biodiversity and climate finance can be effective gadflies that maybe keep the whole thing honest. But problems come when we don't know who we're dealing with and start giving outliers and ideologues more credence than we give the concurrent views of bona fide experts. One of my objectives with Bionic Planet is to help you understand where different groups are coming from, and also to help you separate fact from fiction, and both of those from inadvertent fuzziness like we're looking at today. Sometimes all I can really do is help you find the right questions, because deforestation isn't a puzzle book with answers in the back. It's a wicked problem with no simple solution. And if you think I'm doing a good job of unpacking the nuances for you, then you can help me deliver more and better episodes by becoming a patron at patreon.com/bionicplanet. That's patreon.com/bionicplanet. There you can support the show for as little as $1 per episode and with a monthly cap. And then we get to the issue of settlements, which can be concessional if they're on government land or possessional if they're on private property. And the Moriokas, what they're basically saying is we have the titles. They're saying we have the documentary ownership. And beyond that, we also have possession. We can demonstrate that we've exercised control over the land, that we've been paying taxes on it. The state has been accepting our taxes. And they also went out and got this legal opinion by, got the names here now, Rodrigo Janot, and he's the former federal attorney general under Dilma Rousseff, and then Ige Brito, a former Supreme Court justice, both of them saying that the Moriokas don't lose ownership by having their titles blocked or even canceled because they have this possession as well. So they're basically saying they've got it two ways. And if I understand correctly, the argument the Moriokas are making about the settlements are basically saying that even though we had control, even though, you know, we could have been chopping the trees, we could have been timber harvesting, we could have been doing anything up to 20% of the area, we instead permitted these other people to come in. We didn't have to because we were trying to shift to conservation. So now these guys have become recognized as settlers, and you know, we chose not to try to fight them, but they were moving illegal people out. It was complicated. It's hard to tell who they were pushing out. They, you know, illegal loggers, or were they first pushing out squatters? I don't really know all that, but this is the gist as I understand it. And they're saying that, hey, we've basically been nicer than we had to be, and because we were nice, they have rights. Am I getting the gist there?
Yeah, that's what happened. I think it's called a PAEX in Portuguese. It's a special type of land called agro-extractive communities, where populations in Portel, they're called ribeirinhos, the people living on the river, so to speak, and they're allowed to fish, farm. They're even allowed to cut trees, actually, in those places, because the assumption is the extraction of wood and other resources will be on a small scale. So it's allowed. And actually, those communities are good guardians of the land. They can look after the land. Yeah. So they are on some of the Morioka lands, those reserves exist. Yeah. And that was the key argument used by the defender in an accusation of the RET projects, was that there was unfair treatment from Morioka of those communities. Their rights weren't recognized, basically, effectively. That's what she argues.
Okay. And can you flesh that out? How is she saying that they didn't recognize the rights?
Her whole point is the land has always been public, right? If I'm not saying it's my opinion if it's the case or not. I'm saying what's her opinion. Her legal case is the land has always been public. They never managed to prove that someone bought the land and transferred from public inventory. Point. Given that the land is public, under the agrarian reform, because as Ollie mentioned, Lula comes in the 2000s with the whole platform to redistribute wealth in Brazil. So under the Brazilian agrarian reform law, you can take this land and can give to poor people, to those communities who are agro-extractivists. And in turn, they would stay there. They have to follow some rules from the government. They can chop the land, but they can chop everything. They still have to follow the Brazilian legislation for the Amazon, which is very strict. So her whole point is that you didn't prove the land's yours. It's public. And we are redistributing this land to those communities because they live there and we are giving them the settlements. That's her whole point. And that actually would fall, again, it's a very specific situation for Brazil, but it would fall under the first category, the documentary one, because once the process finished, it isn't finished by this point. And what the public defender is asking is for official intervention on those lands. So the land titles are canceled. What she wants, what she's trying to get, is intervention in the properties. But let's suppose the case is finished. Let's suppose if she wins, for an example, then the land would be redistributed for those communities and there will be documents saying they are entitled to live in those lands. But the land belongs to them, but they still have to follow guidelines from the government. But in any case, the end goal from the public defender's office is to recognize the right and to issue the official document saying they live there and they are the owners of that land. So that's where we're coming from. Whether she's going to get or not, or whether she has a point or not, it remains to be seen. Even the judge of the case accepted her legal dispute, so he accepted to discuss the merit of the case, but he has asked for the opinion of the public ministry. So in Brazil, you have this figure of the public ministry, which takes order from the government. It's a bit hard to explain, but it's this public authority within the justice system that make sure the constitution is being followed, make sure that people have access to justice, etc., etc. The judge has asked for them to issue a report stating their opinion because the public defender has told her opinion, has opened the case. The Moriocas and the project developers have also issued reports rebuking her points. And now the judge is, okay, public ministry, you are a third party neutral here. What do you think about? And we still don't know what they think about. That's still to be seen. And it would be very interesting to see the legal review of the public ministry because whatever they say do have a lot of weight for judges' opinion usually. And usually are taken into consideration within the whole judicial system. So pretty much that's what her point is. She wants those communities who are poor, who are under the agrarian reform law, to get ownership, to get officially settled in those properties. And that's what remains to be seen.
Some of the counter arguments are A, that the Moriocas had control, so they have it as well. And the other is there was rampant deforestation from illegal loggers. When you look into the design documents, what they were saying is that these people on the lands, they don't really understand their rights. They don't know how to do sustainable land management. And what we want to do is work with them, help them get registered under the CAR, which is a kind of recognition, but we still want to be the owners. And it does say in the document that there will be eventually, when carbon finance comes in, there'll be a share. But the gist was that the value they were going to bring as project developers is we're going to go to these people because they're getting inundated by illegal loggers. And those people are brutal. They're not afraid to kill people. They can be a pretty nasty lot. So they were kicking these settlers around. And these guys said that we're going to get you guys registered under the CAR, which is I forget the Portuguese word for it, but that's a registry to say that you have your control over this area. So then you can at least have that claim, which is not a title, but it's a step towards it. And then in return, we want you to make conservation agreements with us, and we're going to work together to manage the land sustainably. And I think, at least in one of the documents, there was a provision that eventually they would even transfer the ownership after 40 years. And then what the Moriocas also pointed out is they paid taxes on the land all those years. The settlers never did. If I understand correctly, the way they look at it is, hey, we're legally right. And if we do lose a court case, the state's going to have to pay us back for all those taxes. And that kind of leads to the next iteration on this is that there's a negotiation going on with ETERPA. And I don't think we talked about what ETERPA is. And this only showed up in the document because Vera had asked them to submit a detailed legal analysis. And they were delaying that because there was this negotiation going on where they're talking to ETERPA and they finally got a 45-day extension. Vera hasn't said why they granted the extension, but the Moriocas did file a detailed legal analysis saying, hey, look, first of all, here's the legal argument. Legally, we think we're solid, but on top of that, we're also still trying to work out an extrajudicial agreement where everyone can agree that Moriocas have this status, the settlers have this status, and we're going to share any carbon proceeds accordingly, right? That's kind of where we're at now. is that this thing is going on. And if they get that agreement, though, they still have to present that to the defender, right? It's not a legally binding thing unless she agrees to it, or we don't really know what has to happen next.
It's a very complicated situation, but DATERPA has a lot of say in this. So the whole process of the whole state.
And tell us what DATERPA is. I don't think we've mentioned them. They're the state authority.
Yeah, DATERPA is the state land agency from Pará. So you have in Brazil the national one, which is INCRA, and then have each state have their own land agency. In Pará is DATERPA. They are allowed to issue their own opinions on the case, and the whole 2006 state block wide goes back to DATERPA. So to let's suppose you get your land title blocked or canceled. You have to go to DATERPA to prove them that the situation is okay. So to get everything back on track, you have to convince them. You have to show them the documents they are requesting to you. Once they are satisfied or they think you proved your case, then they can reverse those land blocking. In theory, if they do, but again, I wanted to make sure everyone is on the same page. It's a very legal, tricky, complicated situation because it's different legal cases coming to one legal case combined. It's for Frankenstein, to be honest. But if the Moriocas can make a deal or agreement with the DATERPA, then they would be much, much ahead in their dispute. That would be much easier to reverse because that's the main point of the Supreme Court. When the Supreme Court judged the state block, they were like, I'm going to keep those land titles blocked. You go back to Pará and then you talk to the land agency. And if they are okay, then it's reversed. So you're pretty much doing what the Supreme Court asked you to do. But that said, we have to still to see what the DATERPA will say or not. They still haven't issued a final report on this.
Most of the credits we're talking about here have gone in the $1 to $2 range. So they haven't really made a ton of money. And they're fighting over something that doesn't really exist. And some people have kind of hinted to me that it's because of concerns about the titles. But if there is an DATERPA agreement, it seems to me that it would essentially be what's in the original project design documents, but with more legal heft to ensure that the conservation can continue. There's one problem they're having with the DATERPA agreement is that a lot of settlers have come in recently who weren't there before, so that there's this sense of, hey, oh, look, there's a red thing going on. Let's go get a piece of that. Jonas even pointed out at one point, and I haven't verified it, and I've actually never spoken to him. I've only seen his messages and stuff, but he says the settlements have only been designated on areas where the carbon project is, which to me sounds pretty shake and bake, but you know, maybe there's an explanation for that. Getting back to this negotiation at hand, it seems to be an effort to say, okay, look, these are the people who are involved. These are the people who get their share, and then we draw the line. We don't let people aren't going to come piling in, right? These are the people who get their share, and the project can then move forward. And then if prices go up, there will be something to share for everybody. But even if prices don't go up, people have gotten some tangible benefits. They've gotten registered under the CARB, which again is not a title, but it's better than what they had. And they've gotten trained in agroforestry. They've gotten social benefits that the state was not providing, such as these schools, 6 built and 10 under construction, right?
10, yes. 6 schools finished, 10 on the way, but essentially work stopped last July, last August, as far as I know. So it's been quite a few months now without any progress on the schools. And that's essentially, you know, since the project was suspended, the money stopped rolling in. Not that the projects were making, as you said, a ton of money. That was the original accusation from an NGO called the World Rainforest Movement. But that's not, from what we've seen, that's not been backed up by the facts here. And so, yeah, the schools have been partially built and the developers are waiting on news around the DATERPA deal to decide whether to continue or not. From what we've seen, the communities themselves are quite desperate for the schools to be built and completed. So much so that they've actually filed a case against Vera in the last few weeks. We've seen a legal case started to try and get Vera to kind of speed up the resolution.
There was some question on that as to whether the people who signed off on the lawsuits had the legal standing to do so. Has that been resolved or is that still ongoing? Do we know
about
that?
Not as far as we know. Yeah.
Okay.
I guess it's often the key factor here, like who can speak on behalf of the community? Are they allowed to? And I think the judge is still looking into that. So it's just adding another layer of complexity. And
there is also a history of groups. CIMI, which is the Indigenous Missionary Council of Brazil, has a history of trying to fight red projects by getting somebody to sign a piece of paper or forging signatures, they've done, and then claiming that the community is being represented here. So that is also always really complicated. I just want to reiterate that the World Rainforest Movement, I've looked into them, and they're funded by this group, Olin Gay GmbH, which is funding a lot of this stuff that's against red. This report got funding from them, and I looked into their 2022 annual report, and they actually say, this is a quote, opposing red and supporting communities in their struggles against the imposition of red projects in their territories are among WRM's key activities. There are groups out there that are devoted to going in and finding things wrong. Now, there's nothing wrong with finding something wrong if your objective is to make things work. But you go into any community, you go into the city of Chicago, you go into a family, you're going to find something that is wrong. It doesn't mean, therefore, the city shouldn't exist or something like that. I find they take things to an extreme level.
Yeah.
That's my soapbox. You can comment or not.
Agree with that. The other element, of course, is that there's a huge amount of media scrutiny in Brazil around Red Plus right now, because the country's in the process of adopting a bill that will regulate the market. There's a lot of hope that carbon credits can be a source of revenue for a lot of people in Brazil, for developers, for landowners, for intermediaries, because the country's got a huge potential, right, for carbon markets, not just Red Plus, all sorts. So there's a lot of interest. There's a lot of money at stake, I'd say, in general. There's a lot of interest around Red Plus amongst the media and other actors. So there's already quite a lot of reporters and other types of actors looking into these projects as well. We know one of the big US papers is doing a story on Portel and other aspects of Red Plus right now.
Yeah, and I spoke to a reporter from Manga Bay who interviewed a lot of people on the ground, which we weren't able to. And he said he did find that people, they didn't always necessarily understand the intricacies of the Red Project. But what he did say is, A, those schools are definitely there and that people definitely want this thing to continue. He felt like that the people in the community were saying, hey, we don't like this aspect or that aspect, but they really want the project to continue. And didn't the defender at one point say the schools weren't there, which is because the schools
are
definitely
arguing. She's still arguing that. Vinny talked to her last week, and she still questions whether the schools have actually ever been built, which is interesting, because all the evidence that we've seen, including, as we've said, people who've visited the project, shows that they have been built or are in the process of being built for some of them.
And if anybody wants more details, they should go to see the piece itself, which is pretty long, pretty exhaustive. Thought you did a great job of wrapping this stuff up. I was really impressed as I read it through. The title again? The
title is How a Decree Created a Red Old Mess and a New Effort to Fix It.
Yeah. And that's on Quantum Commodity Intelligence. So that your website is QR. What is your website again? The
QCintel.com. QCintel.com.
Okay. Okay. Thank you very much. I appreciate your time. And any other comments you guys want to throw in here before I let you go? Or do you think we hit the important things? Okay.
Yeah, no, it's all good.
Olivier Lejeune of Quantum Commodity Intelligence wrapping up this episode of Bionic Planet together with his colleague, Vinny Maffei. If you like the show and want more and better episodes in Season 9, you can help me deliver them by becoming a patron at patreon.com/bionicplanet. That's patreon.com/bionicplanet. There you can support the show for as little as $1 per episode and with a monthly cap. By the same token, if you're an ethical business looking to reach a global climate-aware audience and to associate your brand with ecological results over ego, ideology, and opportunism, then you can sponsor the show by reaching out to me directly at steve@bionic-planet.com. That's steve@bionic-planet.com. I'll be back next week with another episode. Until then, I'm Steve Zwick in Chicago. Thanks for listening.